Okay, so you've nailed your complaints to a church door. You've sparked a reformation. You've been declared a heretic by both the Pope and the Emperor. You've survived multiple assassination attempts. And you've successfully hidden out in a castle for a year. What's next on your to-do list if you're Martin Luther? Well, if you're smart, you start thinking about what happens when the most powerful man in Europe decides he's had enough of your theological shenanigans. With that introduction, if you've been following along in our series, you know that we're backing up a bit to take a look at something there's a good chance you've never heard of, even if you have a working knowledge of the Reformation. It's called the League of Schmalkalden. This is a story about nervous princes, frustrated emperors, theological debates, and ultimately a war that would reshape the religious landscape of Europe. Let's set the scene. It's 1530, and the Protestant Reformation is about 13 years old. That awkward teenage phrase where it's not quite established, but definitely too big to ignore anymore. The Roman Emperor, Charles V, without doubt the busiest man in Europe, he has a problem. Actually, has several problems. The Turks are knocking on Europe's eastern door. France keeps picking fights with him. And now half of Germany, his real power base, has decided to follow some stubborn monk in Wittenberg instead of the Pope in Rome. So Charles calls for a diet, that is, an imperial assembly in Augsburg. His hope is to resolve the whole Protestant thing peacefully. Luther's chief assistant, Philip Melanchthon, presents the Augsburg Confession, which is basically a, hey, here's what we believe, and it's really not that different from historic Christianity document. The Augsburg Confession is carefully worded. It aims to keep the peace and attempts to show that Lutherans aren't a bunch of crazy revolutionaries, but rather Christians trying to reform genuine abuses. The emperor's response? Well, essentially it was, that's nice, now recant or else. And the or else from Charles V, that wasn't an idle threat. This was a man who ruled Spain, the Netherlands, parts of Italy, Austria, significant portions of the Americas, and held the title of Holy Roman Emperor. When he said or else, he had the resources to back it up. The Protestant princes suddenly realized they might need to do more than just print pamphlets and write stern letters. And this is where a guy named Philip of Hesse enters our story. Philip was what we might call proactive. He was young, energetic, politically savvy, and convinced that if the Protestants didn't hang together, they would most certainly hang separately. In December of 1530, he started organizing a political and military alliance that would become the Schmalkaldic League, named after the town where the founding document was signed. Luther initially had a problem with the idea. His theology of the two kingdoms, that is the spiritual and the temporal realms, really made him uncomfortable with the idea of resisting the emperor with military force. To Luther, the emperor was God's appointed authority, and Romans 13 was pretty clear about submitting to that governing authority. But here's where it gets interesting. The Lutheran princes and their lawyers made a fascinating argument. They said that Charles V wasn't just their overlord, he was also constitutionally bound by imperial law. As emperor, he had sworn to uphold certain rights and privileges of the princes and cities. Therefore, if he violated those constitutional guarantees by attacking them for their religion in violation of their territorial rights, they wouldn't be rebelling against legitimate authority. No, they'd be defending legitimate constitutional law against a ruler who had overstepped his bounds. It was a 16th century version of, we're not resisting the government is violating its own rules. Now, Luther loved a good legal loophole almost as much as he loved a good theological argument. He eventually came around to their position, though he was never entirely comfortable with it. The League officially formed in February of 1531, and the founding members were an interesting bunch. You had Saxony under John Frederick I, that was Luther's primary protector. There was, of course, Hesse under Philip, and various other princes and free cities, including Strasbourg, Ulm, and eventually Bremen, Magdeburg, and others. Now, at its height, the League represented a significant chunk of Protestant Germany, and of course, that would be Lutheran Germany. They set up a defensive military alliance with a common treasury, appointed commanders, and established a protocol for mutual defense. If Charles attacked one member, he attacked them all. It was essentially NATO, but for Protestants, and with, of course, a lot more theological debates. The organizational structure was actually quite sophisticated. They had regular meetings, they coordinated diplomatic efforts, and even established a war council. They weren't just a loose association of nervous princes, they were a genuine political and military force. And they needed to be, because Charles V wasn't the only threat. Catholic princes in Germany, especially the Duke of Bavaria and others, were none too pleased about the Protestant movement either. Their religious landscape of Germany was becoming increasingly polarized, with Catholic and Protestant territories eyeing each other suspiciously across now very uneasy borders. For over a decade, the League and the Emperor engaged in a complex dance of diplomacy, threats, and occasional truces. Charles wanted to deal with the Protestant problem, but he kept getting distracted. You see, if he wasn't at war with France, he was at war with the Ottomans, or he was putting down insurrections in Italy. It turns out running an empire where the sun never sets doesn't leave much time for dealing with theological controversies in Germany. For their part, the Protestants used their time wisely. They strengthened their military capabilities, they expanded their membership, and continued the work of reformation in their territories. Churches were reorganized according to Lutheran principles, monasteries were dissolved, and the evangelical movement spread through preaching and printing. This period also saw some of the more colorful theological disputes within Protestantism itself. We've already talked about the sacramentarian controversy where Luther and Zwingli debated how to understand communion, also known as the Lord's Table. Philip of Hesse, the spark plug who got the Schmalkaldic League together, tried to broker peace between Luther and Zwingli at the Marburg Colloquy in 1529. They agreed on 14 out of 15 points, but couldn't resolve the 15th, the nature of Christ's presence in communion. Now, I recently visited Marburg in Germany. I had a chance to visit the location of that colloquy. Here's a short video that I shot while I was there. We're standing in the room where the Marburg Colloquy of 1529 took place between October 1st and 4th. Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon from the German Lutheran Reformation met with the leaders of the Swiss Reformation to hammer out an agreement between them so they could merge their movements. There were 15 points that they wanted to agree on. They were able to agree on 14 of them. The last one that they were unable to agree on was the nature of communion. So this is where that took place. Now, despite some internal disagreements, the Schmalkaldic League held together, united by the common threat of imperial suppression. By 1546, Charles had finally cleared his schedule enough to deal with the Protestant problem in Germany. He'd made temporary peace with France and the Ottomans, and he was ready. The trigger was partly theological, partly political. Philip of Hesse and John Frederick of Saxony were placed under an imperial ban, essentially being declared outlaws of the empire, officially for various political offenses, but everyone knew that religion was really at the heart of it. So the Schmalkaldic War broke out in July of 1546. Charles was savvy enough not to frame this as a purely religious war. He claimed that he was simply enforcing imperial law against rebellious princes. That allowed him to recruit some Protestant princes to his side, notably Maurice of Saxony, who had political ambitions of his own and saw an opportunity. And that ties back to the episode on the Wars of Religion and what I said about how, while this period is often called the Wars of Religion, the real cause was often more political and economic than it was religious. The war initially went poorly for Charles. The League's forces were larger, they had good defensive positions, but then things started to fall apart for the Protestants through a combination of strategic errors, a lack of unified command, and good old-fashioned betrayal, prompted by, yeah, you guessed it, politics. The decisive blow came at the Battle of Marburg in April of 1547. Charles decisively defeated John Frederick's forces, captured the elector himself, and effectively broke the back of Protestant resistance. It was a devastating military defeat for the Schmalkaldic League. Martin Luther, mercifully, didn't live to see this catastrophe. He had died in February of 1546, just months before the war began. One wonders what he would have made of it all. The theological movement that he'd sparked had become a military and political conflict of the first order. Charles V's victory seemed complete. He imposed the Augsburg Interim in 1548. It was a religious settlement that tried to force Protestants to accept Catholic practices while making a few minor concessions. It was deeply unpopular, largely unenforceable in Protestant territories. But here's the fascinating thing. Charles's victory was ultimately hollow. He couldn't fully suppress Protestantism. It had just simply spread too far, it had taken root too deeply, and had too many powerful defenders. When Maurice of Saxony, who'd betrayed the League, switched sides and allied with France against Charles in 1552, the emperor's position collapsed. That then led to the Peace of Augsburg in 1555, which established the principle of whose realm, whose religion. Princes could choose Lutheranism or Catholicism for their territories. Calvinism simply wasn't included in that arrangement, yet. It wasn't religious freedom as we understand it today. Subjects were expected to follow the prince's religion or move. But it was official recognition that the Protestantism was not going away. The League of Schmalkalden had failed militarily, but succeeded its ultimate goal, ensuring the survival of the Reformation in Germany. So, what do we learn from the League of Schmalkalden? I think we can learn several things. First of all, ideas have consequences, and theological convictions sometimes require political and even military defense. The reformers weren't just academic theologians. They were men who had to navigate the very real, very dangerous politics of their age. And second, the Reformation succeeded not just because of its theological arguments, but because it had political defenders willing to risk everything. Those princes weren't perfect. Philip of Hesse's bigamy scandal, that's a story for another day. But they provided the necessary protection for the evangelical movement to survive and to spread. Third, even military defeats can lead to ultimate victory. The League lost the war, but it won the peace. Protestantism survived, thrived, and permanently changed the face of Western Christianity. The story of Schmalkalden reminds us that church history, it isn't just about theological debates and doctrinal formulations. It's about real people making difficult decisions in dangerous times, navigating the intersection of faith and politics, and sometimes having to defend the truth with more than just their pens